You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
This is Glenn Lowry at the Glenn Show at bloggingheads.tv, and I'm very happy to welcome Professor Peter Scarry, Professor of Politics at Boston College, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and an expert on American ethnic politics, and also a former student of Nathan Glaser. Am I not correct in saying so?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
So welcome, Peter. Welcome to the Glenn Show.
It's nice to be here, Glenn. Nice to see you.
It's good to see you, too. It's been a long time. We did spend some time together, but my God, it's been some years ago, hasn't it?
It has.
You're looking well, I must say.
Well, thank you. So are you.
Well, thank you. I don't mind hearing it. I celebrated my 70th birthday not that long ago. And I guess if you get that old, you know, either you go into hiding or you brag about it all the time. So I'm bragging about it.
Okay.
Peter, I invited you on the Glenn Show to talk about Nat Glaser, who you knew very well. Nat Glaser, professor of sociology and education at Harvard University for so many years. A fabled New York intellectual, depicted along with his colleagues Daniel Bell, Irving Howe, and Irving Kristol in that famed documentary Arguing the World about the New York intellectuals and the alcove culture at City College back in the day. And you knew Nat very well, and Nat passed away recently at the age of 95, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, 1 month away from his 96th birthday.
Nathan Glaser, the author with Daniel Patrick Moynihan of Beyond the Melting Pot, a book published when, 1962, am I?
I think right? 63.
That had such a big influence in its description of the changing landscape of American ethnicity over the course of the 20th century. You actually had a close friendship with Pat Moynihan too, did you not? Did you not work on his staff at one time?
I did work for him for at one time for a brief stint, and I wasn't as close to Pat Moynihan certainly as I was to Nat Glaser, but
yeah,
I had a relationship and was felt privileged to have done so.
Yeah. Glaser, Moynihan, Beyond the Melting Pot, Glaser of Affirmative Discrimination, is that what that controversial book was called, in which he argued with some critical edge about the problems with affirmative action policies?
That was the title, and that was the gist of the argument.
Yeah. Nat Glaser, I'm not going to exhaust his bio here, but I also think of we're all multiculturalists now. This declaration that he issued at the height of the culture wars, basically, many thought, conceding way too much to the multiculturalists, but in a way, if you will, Glaser-esque way, acknowledging the compelling reality of a certain view about the world that he didn't necessarily share, but that he realized that he had to learn how to live with, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would you disagree with my characterization of that?
Of his the trajectory from affirmative discrimination to are we all multiculturalists now, that trajectory?
Well, it invites an examination of that trajectory. I was just touching on what I thought were some of the high points of his writing over the course of 40 years or so. And
yeah,
you know, and there is an issue about the trajectory between those books and so on, but maybe we should work our way into that in a more systematic way.
Okay.
Well, I mean, why don't we start then by you telling me and anybody who's listening in how you remember Nat and how you came to know him and what you thought of as some of the, you know, the most significant contributions that he made to American intellectual life.
Well, I came to know him as a graduate student. I was actually on my way to studying neo-Marxist economics with Sam Bowles and Herb Gintis.
I didn't know that about you, Peter.
Yeah, and that was all happening in and around the School of Education at Harvard in the early 70s.
Schooling in Capitalist America, I'll bet.
Yes.
That was the Bowles and Ginter's book of that era that I know I remember reading as a graduate student. That in those same years at MIT, it had a big impact on me.
Yeah. And, but I also took at the same time, I took a seminar, that, Nat was giving on ethnicity and social policy, and, wrote a paper for him that was eventually published in the public interest, as it turns out, about, the abortion debate, and why I thought, many Americans, working class, lower middle class Americans, were not comfortable with the direction of the abortion debate at the time, which wasn't a good thing for a neo-Marxist economist in the making to be arguing, but that's another story. But he was very receptive and encouraging of my perspective, and was similarly so for many years. I mean, that was a as you know, a very open and enthusiastic kind of mentor. He was hard to pin down. Not that I spent a lot of time when I first knew him, trying to pin him down. But he was always rethinking, reconsidering things. And if you had something that he thought was a different angle, a different perspective, he was one of the most open people to trying to, you know, kick it around with and encouraging you to explore it.
Let me ask you this. Do you fancy yourself as a person who has, you know, in a sort of characteristic way, a different perspective? I mean, I noticed your comment about the abortion debate. I'm intrigued. I'd like to know just what you were arguing, but you emphasized that it wasn't a good thing to be arguing in the certain company that you were keeping. And that Nat was a guy who was open to, you know, open to a wide range of views. Do you see yourself as somehow being that guy with the outline view, often?
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. Not that I, style myself as an outlier the way Nat Glaser was an outlier. But I do think in broad terms, we probably share that tendency to kind of, go our own ways when we saw fit to do so.
When you say Nat was an outlier, are you speaking of him as a neoconservative in a world in which it was just kind of politically incorrect, although that's an anachronism, but they wouldn't have said that at that time, to be a neoconservative?
Well, as you know, he never would apply that label to himself. And rejected it explicitly at various points. But the world being what it is, and the fact of his close friendship and associations with people like, Irving Kristol, and other neoconservatives, he would be placed among them, yeah, continually. But, as they would tell you, and as his writings would indicate, he departed from the neoconservative perspective many times, on many occasions, very explicitly, and he would never self-consciously define himself as part of any political or intellectual movement. Not that he would stand on principle or something to say that I'm not part of anyone's parade, but that was just the way he operated. He was his own person, not in any aggressive, self-conscious way, but he was always reevaluating, rethinking things, often hard to pin down, not always the easiest person to engage in conversation, as you probably know. Not exactly evasive, but not very linear sometimes. But that's because he was constantly looking at things from different sides and different angles, often as you're talking to him.
I'm trying to figure out, I'm sitting here trying to think, how do we say you and I in this conversation to whoever might be listening, who might be under the age of 60, and maybe therefore did not live through, I don't know, the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and the kind of intellectual turmoil and conflict around domestic and foreign policy. But I think with Nat, we're talking about mainly domestic policy issues and education and social welfare and the management of cities and responses to crime, in issues like affirmative action, in dealing with the homeless. I mean, I could go down the list of these kind of things, the kind of things that one would pick up this wonderful journal that had quite a good run, The Public Interest, that he and Irvin Kristol founded, if I'm not mistaken, and edited for many years, along with others. Pat Moynihan was involved. James Q. Wilson was involved. Aaron Wildowski was involved. I was even on the publication committee there for a while. But the kind of issues that would come up in that magazine where, you know, there was a pat line on the left about what social justice might require, what a decent society would insist upon. But then there was this stubborn reality, you know, mugged by reality, neocons, liberals mugged by reality. There was this stubborn reality that the data didn't bear it out, or it wasn't so clear, or it might be unintended consequences, or it might be counterproductive, or it might even be rooted on the wrong values. It might even get down to fundamental critique of what purportedly self-evident liberal values are supposed to be, that we're not so self-evident after all, which I think in the case of affirmative action would be so. In any case, how do we convey to the audience a sense of what this, of what the intellectual turmoil was? I mean, you lived through it. How did you experience it? Help me out here. I want to try to paint a picture that Nat fits into of, you know, I remember some of these books, like The Unheavenly City. This is Banfield. I remember the fight in education intellectual circles about Herrnstein and meritocracy the potential, the limits to reform. Of course, remember thinking about crime. This is Jim Wilson and all of the arguments going on around the management of socially disruptive behavior and whatnot. And anyway, I'm trying to lay out a map of what this intellectual terrain of conflict looked like, so that we can situate. You say that Nat Glaser wouldn't have embraced the label, wouldn't have wanted to think of himself as a neocon. That's a kind of stick figure projection of how he might have thought himself. But what about this world that he was immersed in?
Well, that's a great question. It's actually one I've been thinking about, because as one gets older and as one regrets and then regrets the passing and celebrates the life of a mentor like Nat Glaser, you think about the people who are coming up younger than oneself, obviously. Sounds like that's what you're doing too. Yeah. And the milieu that he comes out of, I think, is an important one to convey, and one that's so different from today. The first thing I would say is that it's really important to understand that he was clearly an academic. He spent the last 50 years of his life as an academic, but that's not how he spent the first 40 years of his life or the first 20 years of his professional life. He was in publishing. He was an editor at Anchor Books. He was a editor at Commentary Magazine. He published two books before he got his PhD from Columbia in 1962. I think he actually published three books by that time. He reflects a really interesting environment when New York City was clearly the leading city of the United States, if not the world, in the immediate aftermath of World War II. The United Nations had just moved there. It was the site of all these emigre European, especially German intellectuals who came to New York City. It was the center of commerce, broadcasting. It's such a different place than Washington, D.C. is today, which is one of my favorite cities to live in, and I've lived there. But New York City in the late 1940s and 1950s was a place where many, many different people rubbed elbows and interacted with one another from different spheres of life that I think is so different from university, academic, and intellectual life today. And I'm inclined to think, I don't know if you would agree, that people back then in that milieu, they had their disagreements, clearly. And, you know, there were lots of people who didn't talk to lots of people after debates over specific issues. But I do think they had an ability to talk about and debate political, policy, cultural issues in a way that I don't think we have today. And I don't mean we as a nation. I think we as academics and intellectuals. I think we've lost some of that. There were profound disagreements between, Daniel Bell, Irving Kristol, Nat Glaser, and various other neoconservatives, Nat, and these others, but they maintained friendships over a lifetime. They had respect for one another. They disagreed where they disagreed. It was a very unique environment, I think, and quite different from today's.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of his ideas.
Okay.
He was in education and sociology at Harvard. How did that come about? Education and sociology. Was he a tenured member of the department in sociology? What exactly was the overlap between the sociology and education stuff that brought him to the ed school at Harvard? You said that's when you encountered him?
Right. When I encountered him in the early 1970s, he had a joint appointment in sociology and in the School of Education. But his arrival at Harvard, I think it was 1968, maybe 69, was primarily at the School of Education, where the Ford Foundation had been encouraged to set up several endowed chairs at Harvard to look at, to focus on social policy. And one of them was at the School of Education. And that hadn't been a primary focus of Nat's work, but it had been evolving or begun to evolve in that direction. So he was first and foremost located physically and I think in many ways professionally in the School of Education. I remember that I was one of the few PhD students in sociology, which is what I eventually pursued when I came back to Harvard, although I wound up getting my degree in political science. But very few sociology students spent very much time with Nat. He was not, he didn't fit into the mold, I think politically they thought, because this was the time of affirmative discrimination, when he wrote that book. But also he wasn't integrated into the increasingly professionalized sense of the discipline that was clearly already very dominant in sociology.
Excuse me, this is in part a statement about methodology, about how he pursued his intellectual interests in terms of quantification and, you know, this kind of sort of theoretical grounding, this kind of thing. I'm asking.
It certainly would have been a question, partly based on sort of increasingly sophisticated uses of quantitative technique, sure. But it would also have been a lack of preoccupation with social theory, which Nat certainly didn't have. He knew a lot of that. He worked with a lot of those German immigrant social theorists in the 40s. But by the time of at Harvard, I think that had long since been pushed to the side for him. So it was not, and he would be the first to tell you that he didn't consider himself at the center of the sociological profession. He never did. was always kind of tangential to his broader and more complicated interests or multifaceted interests.
Yeah. Tell us about affirmative discrimination. What was the argument there, and why was it so such of a lightning rod of controversy that he might not even be entirely comfortable at an ed school where people would have been offended by that argument?
Yeah, well, as Nat would have been the first to tell you, it was a somewhat delimited but nevertheless hard-hitting critique of affirmative action, especially in the areas of government contracts, quotas imposed on various employment sectors for racial advancement, and of course busing, which is and those kinds of public school integration issues, where he took a pretty a hard line against those kinds of policies, albeit in his way, which is very much like him, acknowledging the burdens of the past, specifically with regard to African Americans and the history of African Americans in the United States, the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow, but not being able to abide affirmative action when it came, when they became quotas. And he argued that you really couldn't distinguish goals from quotas. And that was a step too far. And he argued against that, not on principled grounds so much. That was not his cast of argument. It was always on practical grounds that this really wasn't working. It wasn't going to work. It created a political backlash. It was counterproductive. That was the gist of affirmative discrimination.
Now, this is what, 1978? Am I right in that?
75, I think.
75. My goodness, this is very, very early in the arc of the development of affirmative action policies. And here we are almost a half century later, and they seem to be dug in pretty well. This from the author with Pat Moynihan of Beyond the Melting Pot, that is a person who's surveyed the dynamic of ethnic assimilation and ethnic political interaction amongst the Jews, the Irish, the Italian, the Blacks, the Polish, the Catholics over the course of the first half of the 20th century. What I'm trying to do is to place this argument about affirmative action coming from Nat Glaser in the mid 1970s, with in relationship to his larger views about ethnicity, ethnic assimilation, how it is that ethnic groups get along and make it in American society, or how it is that America's multi-ethnic political dynamic remains stable and mutually accommodating, this kind of thing.
Yes.
What would you have to say about that?
Well, I'd say that his views of the Black or African American experience clearly evolved, and in Beyond the Melting Pot, he clearly saw African Americans in the context of northern cities. And that he assumed, and he's written about this, he wrote about it subsequently, but he very clearly assumed in the late 50s and early 60s, that the particular burdens and obstacles to, Black mobility, and advancement then were in the same vein as that of other ethnic groups in the North. He wasn't arguing they were all the same, but that over time, the acclimation of Southern Blacks who had moved into New York City in large numbers after the war or before the war, that over time these things would work themselves out as they had for other migrant groups, to avoid using the term immigrant groups, because obviously they weren't immigrants. And that was the framework of Beyond the Melting Pot. And to some extent, I think that that informed his argument against affirmative action in the affirmative discrimination book. But it's also pretty clear, and he wrote about this. He wrote about it in a memorable article in the Dubois Review in 2004 or 5, I forget when exactly, where he began to see that the problems of African Americans were not so readily classed as those of other ethnic groups in America, that they were really quite distinct and required distinct responses and remedies, such as affirmative action, which he eventually, as you know, came around to support, at least in certainly in higher education.
Yeah. So I'm going to veer off a little bit and say something that's not exactly about Nat Glaser, but it's more about affirmative action.
Okay.
And maybe it's more about blacks and assimilation and America's ethnic dynamic political evolution. And that is that here we are now, the year is 2019. We are well past the 1970s and well past, you know, this founding decades of social policy out of which affirmative action emerges. It's very clear that blacks are different. I think politically you have to acknowledge that. I mean, it's very clear that whatever the melting pot dynamic was that was going on for the European ethnics from South and Eastern Europe coming in the early 20th century, that's not the same process of assimilation ongoing for African Americans. You are the author of The Ambivalent Minority, a book about Mexican American ethnicity in the United States. I think you would be quick to observe that that's very, very different than the dynamic characteristic of African American ethnic experience. I don't even know if ethnicity fully encapsulates what is distinctive about African American identity and place within the American social order, social political order. But we could just go down the list of events of the last 5-10 years around ethnicity, race, and so forth, the African American, the Black Lives Matter movement, and so on. Blacks are different.
Mm.
Did Nat get it right? I mean, did he come ultimately into a recognition of the sort of profound exceptionalism of African American ethnicity by the time we get to we're all multiculturalists now? Does a recognition of that profound distinctive experience of African Americans in the realm of ethnicity require something like affirmative action? I mean, could it not be just the opposite at some level? And let me stop talking. I'm asking you questions. I want to hear your answers. But I say that to say, is it a structural phenomenon that creates the distinctiveness of African American ethnicity within the American social melting pot? A structural phenomenon, a remnant of racism and the fact of racial stigma and the history of slavery and Jim Crow? What role do African Americans ourselves have, the political dynamic within the African American society and whatnot in, again, I'm rambling a little bit, forgive me, but I'm thinking about Rogers Brubaker right now. You know who I'm talking about, the guy out at UCLA, ethnicity without roots kind of guy. I'm thinking about ethnic entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about people who, you know, can seize on certain critical issues within the polity and can frame them in a particular way about the degrees of freedom that we have, because issues don't always have to be framed in racial terms, about how easy it is for African Americans to repair to a certain posture when confronted with their problems, how that might actually exacerbate our distinctiveness and so on. Anyway, let me stop. I've said enough. I'm trying to prime the pump because you're a wise man.
Well, we'll see. I appreciate what you're trying to put on the table, though, because I think there's a lot there. I think in the first instance, I think what I heard you possibly responding to when I first answered your question is that it does seem, with all due respect to Nat Glaser, in retrospect, slightly preposterous to think that the problems of Negroes, as would have been said in those days, in New York City were to be so easily equated to those of Italians or Poles or Irish or so forth. Even then, it seems to me that was a stretch. So that's the first thing I would say, but you know, we'll just note that. But then, beyond that, you know, this did Nat get it right, in his subsequent revisionist view of the relatively unique situation, history, and claims of African Americans on American society?
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is to my mind is yes and no. Because I'm struck that, his argument, in later years was clearly along these lines that the particular burdens, of our history make it incumbent upon America, to understand the unique obligations we have and the unique demands that African Americans are making on us and our obligation to respond in some important and unique way. That's very different from any other group claims. But you asserted, I think, something similar to that in your question, and I agree. I'm not so convinced, however, that that's the general consensus in contemporary America. As the author of a book entitled The Ambivalent Minority about Mexican Americans, I'm struck that it's very, very hard to get my students, for example, to understand that there are some very basic differences between the history and the experience of Mexican Americans and Hispanics generally, and the kinds of claims they can make on a contemporary American society, and those of African Americans. Because the general, you know, zeitgeist is that these are racial minorities. And racial minorities are seen as broadly similar and making similarly compelling claims. I find that a very troubling argument. I think that has a lot to do with why so many people are so upset with immigration. And I can tell you more about that and tell you and argue things that might not ring very good to your ears. But I do think, that we are of two minds. When something happens like what's going on in Virginia right now, it's very clear that we're all mindful of our history and of the wrongs that have been committed and continue to be committed as a result of that history. But then when we're talking about, you know, demographically changes in American society, well, we're all becoming, you know, becoming a minority majority nation. Well, what does that mean? To most people, I think, or to many people, certainly to my students, and I'm sure to your students at Brown, unless I'm just ill-informed, it means that we are becoming a society where groups can make racial claims on America for grievances that are equivalent to and similarly compelling to the grievances that African Americans have against us. And I don't accept that. I think that's wrongheaded. And I think that's, and black leaders don't agree with me. I know that, at least not publicly. But I think that's wrongheaded and a misreading of our history and not politically beneficial to American society today and to our debates about these issues.
Or to the interests of African Americans, if you want to look at it that way.
Well, I think that's what I am saying. I am mindful of the interest of African Americans.
And this is something that we're pretty sure Nat Glaser would have agreed with. In fact, he was already kind of agreeing with it, and we're all multiculturalists now.
I would say he kept making these noises. I never felt I could get him to agree with my views to try to reconsider immigration policy vis-a-vis this perspective. In his last writings, he in 2010, he wrote a really interesting article for the American Interest where he's talking about how suddenly, not so suddenly, but we have a black president, but the interests and the issues pertaining to African Americans aren't on the agenda.
Yeah, I saw that.
I think he was exactly right. I have a slightly different answer than he did as to why, but they're related.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I'm just saying that I don't think he was prepared in that article or in other places to push ahead with the logic, which is that maybe we need to either rethink our immigration policy, which I would argue has had pretty deleterious effects on African Americans.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure that's the only criterion to judge our immigration policy, but it's certainly an important one that doesn't get talked about. But let me stop.
Yeah, I want to hear more from you about immigration. Don't be so sure that I will. It won't be kind words to my ears. Although a lot of people might be upset, but I first want to underscore this point about the generalization of the claims based upon African American exclusion claims on behalf of a particular non-white ethnic group within American society, rooted in a history of slavery and Jim Crow institutionalized separation and segregation. Those claims, the moral claims, Gunnar Myrdal's An American Dilemma. What was the dilemma? It wasn't a generalized non-white dilemma. It was the dilemma of the descendants of slaves not being made citizens even 75 years after emancipation. This is Gunnar Myrdal's American Dilemma. But the generalization of those claims. So you know John David Scrittney's book, The Minority Rights Revolution.
Yeah.
And he makes the argument there that when the census, when the bureaucrats are trying to figure out what are the categories for minorities in America, to the extent that a group could argue in analogy with black Americans that their circumstances, whether it was the Japanese being interred or it was the Mexicans being discriminated against, to the extent that they could effectively argue in an analogy with African American subjugation, exclusion and discrimination, they would be more successful in being recognized. He wanted to know why, you know, the Slavic or, Hungarian immigrants weren't a minority, but the Latino immigrants, you know, the ones from Portugal or Spain were a minority. He wanted to know it sort of like that. But what I'm getting at here is the generalization of this claim. So I've been thinking for a long time, Peter, both about the immigration issue, but much more generally in this era of Trump. Trump is a racist. These are brown people trying to come across our border, they say. This is what the left-wing critics of Trump's immigration policy say. I'm not endorsing Trump here. I'm just saying, okay? I'm just saying. I've been listening to this, and I've been saying, whoa, it's racism? You just equated somebody who's not so happy about a relatively uncontrolled and unauthorized entry into the country by people from south of the border who happen to be Latino, speak Spanish as their native language, and maybe are a little swarthy. You just equated that to the African-American circumstance, and you've just created this general category, which you're calling racism, white supremacy, white nationalism. And you're going to take all the political capital that African-Americans have built up over a couple of centuries, and you're going to spend it on legislative battles or policy arguments that actually, maybe, when you count the numbers, work to the detriment of your constituents. I'm talking about African-American political leadership now. I'm talking about cities like Chicago, I'm talking about Roger Waldinger's book, How the Other Half Work, where he does an in-depth analysis of the labor market in Los Angeles. And you know who's in charge of the labor market at the low end in Los Angeles? I'm talking about all this stuff. It seems like wholesale political malpractice, frankly, not to try to husband the uniqueness of the African-American claim, but to allow it to just dissipate into this kind of ether of generalized anti-whiteness. It's a profound mistake, in my view.
Well, I'm so pleased to hear you agreeing with me that I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay. Well,
I feel empowered. But to be seriously, I completely agree with what you just said. But of course, what any African American elected official or politician would tell you is that they need allies.
Yeah.
And that this is how they get them. Now, I'm not sure the allies they're getting are so solid or as numerous as they think. And I think the consequences, and this is what I alluded to before that you might not like the sound of, but I think you'll understand the spirit in which I say it.
Okay.
I think that an important reason why Americans are so unhappy with immigration, and it's a very complicated issue, and it's a whole lot more complicated than just illegal immigration.
Yeah.
But basically, if you have this large group coming into your country, Hispanics, who identify themselves as a racial minority, who have an experience similar to that of African Americans and who deserve the special treatment, shall we say, however unspecial that treatment has been, but you know what I mean. If they merit the same affirmative action and other controversial policies that African Americans have claimed, it doesn't seem to me that that's a very winning posture to get many people supporting immigration. Who in their right minds? I come from a white working class background, in Boston, in blue collar suburbs of Boston. And I can tell you that over my lifetime, I do think that the claims, the unique and special claims that African Americans, have made on American society have finally been acknowledged and for some time by the people that I come from, white working class people. They may disagree about specific policies and so forth, and you could, you know, ask what if they really mean it. But in the basic level of support for policies directed at African Americans and the claims that African Americans can make on the rest of American society, I think that argument's been won. But if that's going to get shared with hundreds of thousands of immigrants coming in who are Hispanics, who in their right mind would say, well, we barely figured this out, how to respond, not solve, respond to the claims and the problems of African Americans. And now we're going to invite in hundreds of thousands of millions of people, Hispanics, who make the same kinds of claims on us. That doesn't seem to me a proposition that's designed to endear itself to large numbers of Americans. But I think that's how it's been framed. And I think that's one reason why people are so, in many ways, irrationally riled up about immigration, because it's a very complicated response. I'll be the first to acknowledge that. But so basically, we don't need this.
Is that, in fact, an accurate description of the tenor of Latino politics? And I'm asking, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is it driven by a sense of victim claim making, entitlement? Is the identity dynamic? Again, I speak from ignorance amongst the Latino, Mexican American ethnic group, who they understand themselves to be and so forth, steeped in a kind of narrative about victimization, dispossession, the discrimination and whatnot. Is there the equivalent of driving while black amongst Latinos of the talk amongst Mexican Americans. If a Mexican American politician rises to prominence, is there the same degree of 90% of voting support for it, et cetera, et cetera? Do you see what I'm getting at here?
Yeah.
I mean, so I'm asking, as a description of the assimilation dynamic characteristic of the Mexican American population, is it objectively similar, either in terms of how they perceive it or how it's actually working out, to that of blacks?
I think,
excuse me.
Sure. I think objectively, I would say the answer to your question is no. I would say it's a middling case. I would say that the particular problems and advancement that you can see generationally for Hispanics generally, but Mexicans in particular, is somewhere between the white norm and the black norm. And why that is, you know, is a more complicated question. And I think, you know, I called my book, The Ambivalent Minority for a reason. It wasn't a psychological term I was using. It was a political term that, if Julian Castro, who's now running for president, I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to his campaign, thus far, but I have no doubt that an important part of his story is that he's an immigrant and that his mother or grandfather came here and pursued the American dream. And now he's running for president in three generations.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that that's the kind of self-presentation he or somebody like him would make. But I also know that when it comes time to argue about why aren't there more Latinos at the University of California, or why aren't there more Latinos compared to their population in the state at the University of Texas, then the implication is that they're being discriminated against, and the kinds of evaluative frameworks that are used to judge the advancement of African Americans will be used to judge the relative advancement and of Hispanics. So it's a mix and match. It's both. But I think when push comes to shove, and certainly I see this among my students, you know, 20-year-olds who come from Los Angeles,
yeah,
who might not be Mexican, they're Central American, but they see themselves as a minority, a racial minority, and identify with African Americans. They know there are differences, but I think in the political sense, in the broadest political sense, they see themselves as another minority, another racial minority like African Americans.
What are their intermarriage rates?
Very low.
With Anglos.
Very high with Anglos, with whites. Yeah.
No, I know they're low with blacks.
Yeah.
I'm saying they're high with whites. That's my point. I'm saying...
I agree.
So the description that you give might not be accurate in a generation or two.
Well, you would think. But there are remarkably few sociologists. There's a couple like Richard Alba who actually focus on this. Orlando Patterson actually noted this 20 years ago, but it's seemingly a tough argument to make because, and this is where I think I would fault Nat Glaser. I wouldn't fault him strenuously, but I don't think he pushed this perspective hard enough because it's not nice to hear. People don't want to hear a white academic say that you Hispanics don't merit special help and benefits. It comes across as hostile. I don't intend it that way. But I think that's how it comes across.
Well, it shouldn't be up to the white guy to say it. It should be the black guy that's saying it. I should be saying it. I should be the one that defends the exceptional character, because after all, these are exceptional. This is a state of exception. Affirmative action is a state of exception.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that audience is it's a stepping away from a framework and a set of rules that we would all agree behind a veil of ignorance was the rational and sensible way in which to order our affairs. Okay. No. We would not build the system this way. This is reparative. This is ameliorative. It's exceptional. Who better than the beneficiaries of an exceptional arrangement? Ought not to be permanent, ought to be a part of a transition, therefore requiring a historical narrative. Transition from something to something else because of something. In the case of African Americans, a transition from Jim Crow second-class citizenship into something approximating a parity in the social order because of the ugly residue of chattel slavery at the root. And what kind of republic are we going to be if we don't come to terms with that? That's exceptional. Okay. Mm. Who better to defend that against the creeping encroachment? I don't mean to impute motives to anybody. Human nature is to get what you can get. I don't blame people for claims that they can get acknowledged. But somebody, if anybody is going to be able to effectively point out that, wait a minute, just by definition, we don't want exceptional arrangements to become the kind of default way in which we deal with persons coming into a society, which is a nation of immigrants, after all, that's our whole entire history. We don't want that to be extended across the board, et cetera, et cetera. Who better than for African Americans? So I don't think it's your place to say it. I think it's my place to say it.
Well, with all due respect, I'll take some ownership, but I'm happy to have you take the lead. And at the same time, I have a proposition to put to you.
Yeah.
We both know Ernie Cortez.
We do know Ernesto Cortez, yes.
Who's one of the most impressive political organizers, bar none, of any background that I've ever met. And he certainly is a Mexican-American.
Yeah.
I think it would be great sometime if the three of us could talk about this.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's a terrific idea. Let me just tell people who don't know Ernesto Cortez. The Texas Industrial Areas Foundation, Southwest Industrial Areas Foundation, in the spirit of Saul Alinsky, although for a half century he's been doing it his own way, MacArthur Prize genius award winner, organizing people in the Southwest, and an amazing man. I mean, an amazing leader. You, I assume, have participated in some of his training seminars with his organizers. I have certainly done that. It's been some of the most meaningful political/intellectual experiences of my life. I'm not kidding. I'm not making that up. Being in the room with 50, 75 of those people, having them go at you about your ideas, hearing a bit from them about their work and their ideas, and going back and forth about what democracy actually means when it gets down to cases, and how do you get change, and how do you move people so that they have hope, and how do you empower them to be able to define what they want from politics and then to be able to act in a coherent way to pursue it. I love Ernie Cortez. And so, and I have had conversations with him about immigration, man. They've been some of the most difficult conversations I've ever had with my friend, Ernie Cortez.
Yeah, I know.
We could talk about Edmund Burke. We could talk about John Stuart Mill. We could talk about Adam Smith. We could talk about the John Dewey. We could talk about a whole lot of stuff, but that's one of the ones that's very hard to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
But I love him, and that's a terrific idea. So let me work on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what else should we talk about Nat Glaser or whatever you want to talk about?
Where are we? I don't know. I don't think we necessarily exhausted the Nat Glaser thing. Let me ask you, and I don't know how to put this without seeming to be rude, but I don't mean to be. What kind of Jew was Nat Glaser? Where was he on the Israel question? Do you have any idea? You think neocon? You think, you know, the people born after 1980 are going to think, how do we get into the Iraq war? They're going to think Commentary Magazine. They're going to think Norman Pot Horowitz. They're going to think Irving Kristol. I mean, William Kristol. Mm. And whatnot. And they're going to think pro-Israel. They're going to think kind of foreign policy views and stuff like that. Or I don't know, would think that, based upon just common sense and, you know, just looking around, where did Nat fit into that constellation? Did he very much identify as Did he write much at all about the Middle East stuff or about Jewish ethnicity within American society and whatnot?
Well, he certainly wrote a lot about Jews and Jewish identity in America. His second book was Judaism in America. After he wrote The Lonely Crowd with Daniel Bell, with David Reisman, I'm sorry.
Yeah, David Reisman, right.
He continued to write about it. And of course, that was one of the ethnic groups that he wrote about in New York City in Beyond the Melting Pot. I think, he was an outlier in many ways within the context of New York Jewish intellectual life. He wasn't a practicing Jew. I know that, but that might have been true I'm reliably certain
for
many
of them. Yeah.
I once had a conversation with Nat about Patrick Buchanan, most Jewish intellectuals that I know would readily sign on to the notion that many people share that Pat Buchanan is an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that wasn't Nat Glaser's reaction. Mm-hmm. That tells you as much about Nat Glaser being Nat Glaser than it does that about Nat Glaser being a Jew. Mm-hmm. He was the kind of person to just take things one at a time and look at them in their entirety. And from his perspective, I'm not saying he approved of Pat Buchanan, although he didn't express in this particular conversation any disapproval. He would expect in a, you know, pluralistic, competitive society like America, that you've got different groups competing for attention, for resources, for a place on the agenda, and that Pat Buchanan was making an argument about foreign policy that had, you know, that impinged negatively on where a lot of Jews stood, and that didn't make him an anti-Semite. Now, maybe other things that Pat Buchanan has said and did make and made Pat Buchanan an anti-Semite, but Nat Glaser wasn't calling them to mind the day we had this conversation. I mean, I explicitly asked him, do you think he's an anti-Semite? No. So that tells you this is a man who's got different, he's responding to different cues in the world, I think, than many Jewish intellectuals. And I'm not criticizing Jewish intellectuals for coming to a different position. I'm just saying Nat was different. He expected different groups to make different kinds of claims, and he expected them to compete and there to be friction. And I think that's, you know, going back to what we were first talking about with Beyond the Melting Pot, I think that's really the perspective he had with regard to Negroes in New York City in the late 50s. And he changed his mind about that, but other groups I think he saw very much fitting into that pluralist competitive dynamic. As far as Israel is concerned, he was never a very enthusiastic supporter of the state of Israel. As a young man at City College, he was part of a Zionist group that he got recruited to that was headed by, Zelig Harris, who was a young linguist, who went on to become, famous in his own right, but also famous because he was Noam Chomsky's teacher. Uh-huh. And Zelig Harris led this Zionist youth group that was, yes, Zionist, but they wanted a Jewish homeland, but they argued for a bi-national Jewish homeland, one for Arabs and Jews to share, weren't necessarily arguing for a nation state. Nat would be the first to have told you he wasn't quite sure what we were arguing for, but it was something where Jews and Arabs were going to get along. Jews were going to help Arabs escape from feudalism, as he once wrote. I'm not sure he would have said that, you know, in 2010 or put it.
No, I get it.
But I think he reluctantly came to support the state of Israel, in the mid to late 50s. But was not an enthusiastic, zealous supporter of the state of Israel, and clearly was sympathetic, I think, to the Palestinian situation.
You know, Orlando Patterson's book, Ethnic Chauvinism.
Yes.
And I think that Nathan Glazer admired that book. I somehow have a recollection of having conversations with him about some of the arguments in that book. And I mention it because, there's a kind of ethnic chauvinism built into the Zionist enterprise. I think I can say that without being a judgmental one way or the other. I mean, by definition, in a way. And I would have thought that self-conscious nationalistic ethnic aspiration wouldn't have necessarily sat so well with Nathan Glazer.
Well, I'd say yes and no. I mean, he was somebody who was very sensitive to, and responsive to group identity and to the claims of history and group experience. And when he saw Jews in suburban Chicago in the 1950s, as he wrote about in his book, American Judaism, and saw them assimilating to some kind of, he wouldn't have called it milquetoast America, but that's what you and I might call it.
Yeah.
White bread America. He wasn't very pleased with that, and he wasn't pleased with their loss of a serious sense of their history and religion. So I don't know that I would push it so far that, and I'm not quite sure why you say Zionism is, you know, sort of inherently, I'm not sure, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is necessarily chauvinistic any more than any other form of nationalism. Now, if we want to talk about Bibi Netanyahu, that may be a different story, but.
Okay, well, it's an ethnic chauvinism. It's no more chauvinistic than any other form of nationalism, but it's an ethnic nationalism is all that I meant in saying that.
Okay, well, there are lots of ethnic nationalisms, no?
Well, there are, and I mean, they are at least philosophically subject to critique. I mean, If French nationhood nationalism or German nationalism were to be understood in 2019, I understand historically in ethnic terms, I think a lot of people would have a problem with that at some kind of political theoretic level. They might say that the power of the state being harnessed to the aspirations of a community in a community environment is somehow inherently inconsistent with the, equal participation or something like that. Now, that's how my argument would go.
Yeah. Well, here I do feel like I'm channeling Nat a bit. I think, my response to that would be that, that kind of historical sense of ethnic identity and peoplehood that has been conjoined with nationalism in specific contexts, whether it's Germany,
sure,
or France or even in the United States, has important claims on people, and those claims I don't think can be denied. But it doesn't, and when those claims are put forward by German people or French or Americans, it doesn't necessarily mean the exclusion of others. It just means it's a claim that this is our history and it deserves some due. Now, I understand those claims can get pushed a whole lot further and have been and are today. But I don't accept the notion that the claims of history and common peoplehood along some ethnic or racial lines especially ethnic, we'd have to talk about racial, are, you know, necessarily suspect. It's a starting point. And it deserves a certain due. America has a certain history as a Christian nation. And that seems to me undeniable, although many people today want to deny that. They want America to somehow transcend its past. Well, I'm not sure how that gets transcended. And I think in the process, we wind up alienating a lot of people from what they take to be their history and heritage.
Well, you do not hear any sentences that begin with America has a right to exist as a Christian nation. You don't hear the national purpose and raison d'etre articulated to everybody who is a citizen of the country in religious identitarian terms. And if you did, you'd have some problems, I think, with the Constitution of the United States. That doesn't apply in the case of Israel, but I think if we're making transnational assessments about the, you know, kind of moral foundations and legitimacy of governance and whatnot, I don't mean to be misunderstood. I'm not calling into question the legitimacy of the state of Israel.
Yeah.
I'm simply saying that there are some tensions in the Zionist project with certain enlightenment ideal kind of notions about citizenship and equality that I'm quite happy to, you know, as a pragmatist, live with and roll with the punches of. But I don't want to surrender the idea that that there really are some tensions here. There are some problems here.
Tensions I can sign on to for sure.
Okay. Well, Peter, all I can say is professor of politics at Boston College, thanks for your time. It's been an enlightening discussion about Nathan Glaser and other things. And I'm going to work on that Ernie Cortez conversation because I think that would be wonderful, actually. Wonderful. Maybe we can get him up to the Boston area and we can all get together at the Watson Institute here at Brown and have a little forum or something like that. We could get a couple hundred people to turn out for that. And it'd be a lot of fun.
That would be excellent. Yeah. I've enjoyed it. Thanks for suggesting that I come on.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.